Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. Good morning. Special thanks to Emanuela and Bulbul, and I guess Jeff, for the opportunity to be here. This is my second official visit to KATP. The first one was 16 years ago, and I still have an active collaboration that emerged from this visit. So I'm a chemical engineer, so I extrapolate things, right, I guess. So I'm going to use a linear extrapolation, and I think the prospects are rather good.
But we need a dimensionless group. Right?
Indeed. But I've had 10 very stimulating days here. I learned a lot. And as a result of the discussion here, I changed a little bit the presentation from the initial title, even though I will address those two effects. I have tried to put together some thoughts of, relating to comparison of soft and hard, because I think this is pretty much in part of the idea here. And I represent a rather smaller community here in KATP that deals with soft. So let's see how it goes. And obviously I have many things which I don't understand. Okay, so these two gentlemen I did most of the work I will allude to is Daniele from Italy and Leo from France. They work on a European project called Coldens, and Leo is co-advised with my longtime collaborator Michel Croat, who was here in January and with whom we have been doing many things, trying to understand different kinds of soft systems. And I guess time will allow to show, obviously, the systems. The anisotropic systems were obtained from a group in Beijing, headed by Chen Yang Liu, and the star polymers by Mario Gauthier in Waterloo. And Ronit Bitton in Beersheba helped with some scattering that I will show. Okay, so that's the outline. It's a bit long. But this is the way I think about it. I guess one of the interesting problems here is to find ingredients to develop constitutive equations, which I guess by definition are invariant to different flows. And to do that, it's important to link to the microstructure. So then we are experimentalists, and from our standpoint, the link of macroscopic properties to microstructure is an interesting challenge that we try to address. And I will show, I hope, why. So now in this big framework, we're particularly interested in soft systems. So then I will spend some time discussing our view on softness and of course shape and entropic mixing, which are in the titles. And the bottom line is that these are ways to manipulate flow in a rather controlled way. But what we really aim long term is to do what we call molecular design. That means that given a certain flow response of properties, what is the system at molecular level, and then you give kind of the recipe to the chemist. So we work very closely with chemists trying to do so, and I'll show you some examples. Eventually, I will speak about the comparison of stars and microgels, which I hope I will convince you are the two main representatives of softness. Because if you see the literature in softness, it's humongous, really. And I hope that they are good representatives. And of course, I'll make a comparison with hard spheres. And then two things I had in the title was, one, mixing essentially soft particles the effect of shape, and so I'm going to compare soft cylinders with soft spheres in the dense state. And so the bottom line here is that packing, so then in the so-called jammed regime, is particularly interesting and different compared to hard spheres. And the last part, which probably I won't have time to go through, is a mixing of big linear polymers and soft spheres. And the interesting part is that you have a suspension which is liquid, and then if you add large linear polymers, you can essentially vitrify it. Well, so the first day I came here, Wilson talked to me, and he said, okay, well, you know my nice work about shear thickening and so on, so this is from one of his papers. Viscosity that's meant to be zero, the shear viscosity as a function of the shear stress, And then you see the thickening effect, which obviously if you plot against shear rate, then you have also discontinuous thickening and so on. And then he said, well, softness is one of the parameters that has not been studied systematically. And so then we discuss about appropriate systems to approach this. And this is indeed true, but Prabhu Nott, who just left, has done beautiful work. I think it's still in the making, actually, that we saw with Gary recently on PDMS soft spheres with different cross-linking that show similar effects. But nevertheless, this is one motivation that I think is of interest to soft people, right? Okay, so then with apologies to, I guess, those who know about this, I guess most of you know. This is the main experimental test we'll use. So what you do is you put a certain shear rate for a certain time, and then you follow the stress, can be viscosity too, which obviously increases, goes through a linear response, then usually it has an overshoot, and then reaches a steady state. Okay. So then this overshoot, we call it static yielding. So in a way is the minimum stress beyond which the system will flow, and this is the steady state, which often in our jargon we call it dynamic yielding, because it's the minimum stress that the system can really afford staying in the liquid state. And then of course there is the relaxation, which often in dense systems does not go directly to zero, or it may not go to zero. We have the so-called residual stresses, but I will not address this at all. I will address linear response and parts of the non-linear response. So now, obviously, that's a reminder. Typically, this is the flow curve, viscosity versus stress or rate. This is normalized rate. And so then this low rate plateau here is what we call the yield stress. But one can do oscillatory measurements, which are very much in fashion. I think most people do oscillatory than steady shear. And so then you have here a change that should be the strain amplitude, okay, during oscillatory formation. And then you have the storage modulus, G prime and loss modulus. And then there is this crossover. And obviously here the system is solid, here is liquid. So this crossover here is another of the many measures of the yield stress, right? And they are not necessarily the same, but they should be reasonably close. Naturally, in this here determination, the yield stress will depend a little bit on the frequency. This is not a bad thing because it's an activated process anyway. Okay, so now this is what I call standard picture. That's yield stress fluids. So the most popular, I guess, in the literature is carbopole, right? So now, nobody knows what carbopole is, and everybody knows that if you take five carbopole samples from five different companies, there are five different entities, right? Right? The only thing that people agree is that it's a fantastic yield stress fluid, and okay, it's meant to be microwave. Nevertheless, there have been really fantastic experiments with the system, and then important flow phenomena have been really discovered, and so a lot of insight has been gained. So that's a flow curve now, and so you see, you remember as before, okay, that's the way to get the yield stress. But then if you do the reverse experiment, you see that there's something completely different. So you may want to say that I put my carbopole in the rheometer, I'll start shearing, it goes like this, up, and then I go back here. So this is certainly the yield stress. This hysteresis is typical for those systems. This is, of course, a highly dense suspension and so on and so on. Now, so that's one thing is hysteresis, which often in our language is called thixotropy. The other thing is yield stress. The third is now that the carbopole, much like most yield stress fluids, as we know, may slip at the wall, right? So then the zero boundary condition will not be respected. And so you see this because these data here in the bottom are data which were obtained. First of all, you will barely observe a yield stress here in the common way. They were done with smooth plates, as we say. So then if you somehow modify your plates, typically you roughen, you see this thing. And then there's a huge difference here, so then sleep is important. Now, on top of that, as we all know, you can have shear bumming. And so this is now the distance between the two plates, or you know, in a complete device or in quite. And so that's the velocity, and you see that in the beginning your velocity is zero, and then there is a second bound here. So that often people call this coexistence, because yeah, actually you have a part here which basically is pretty much moving with plug flow, and eventually you have the development of the velocity profile. So then we have yield stress, we have slip, we have shear bending, okay, to name a few. And yeah.
So in the serrated plane example, mm-hmm. if you now do this again, so you go up, you come down, you come back that way. But is the hysteresis lost, or if right. I repeat this branch?
Yeah, I do not know for this particular example. I think in this particular one, as they show, okay, they should stay there. But if you do it many times, I really don't know. But I believe that it's not easy to give an answer. The most mechanistic answer that I'm aware of is the classification of yield stress fluids into strong and weak, or if you wish, thixotropic and non-thixotropic, right? So the so-called weak or simple yield stress fluids are the ones which will basically be fully reversible.
Okay. Okay.
So I think that carbopol belongs to the other category, right? The way I prefer to see it is as follows. If I would have a fully repulsive colloidal glass, I expect that I have reversibility, right? If I have a colloidal gel, or if I have any kind of attraction, then I will have hysteresis. That's why, in fact, the field, as far as I know, and I guess Gary is more appropriate to comment, was developed in thixotropy based on flocculated suspensions, which are colloidal gels.
The data on the right measure, do they correspond to some point on the flow curve on the left?
No, they're two different.
Different experiments? Different experiments.
They are taken from two different. So this one here is taken from this review that involves the UBC people and Guillaume Varlet. This one is the early work of Philippe Cousseau.
Right, I can't remember. Is this seen after the yield going up, or is it seen coming down?
I believe that this is still coming down, okay? But I'm not 100% sure. Yeah.
So, what is the kind of interaction of carbopol? Is it the
kind of
interactions? So, is there any attraction, or is it complicated?
I really don't know, because as I mentioned, we don't know. For sure, it's a charge system, so it's a polyelectrolyte, so you'd expect some repulsions. I have no idea how the specific one. Nothing. We don't know anything. Okay. We know that it's a kind of polyelectrolyte. Now, what kind of side products you have? Okay. Even if you have a large dispersity, so then you have depletion effects, which will create some clusters. I really have no idea. And as far as I know, as I mentioned, the literature is really huge. This is not really addressed. I've had discussions with Mort about this, and in fact, this classification of simple and strong yield stress fluids relates to a simple review they wrote some time ago with Daniel Bohn in Science, in fact. Okay, now. So then it's clear that we need to know something about the structure. So the simplest yet indirect way to probe this is linear response. And yet in the field, people usually don't do that. Right? And it's understandable, maybe why, if your system is really treated more from the continuum approach. Yet, I hope to show you that this is useful. So now, if you take any of the systems, it's not the same, And you do a linear response, so basically the frequency dependence of the moduli, that's the typical signature of what we would call a glass. Now, whether it's a thermal glass or a jump glass, we don't know, but this will be pretty much the same. So that's G prime, that's G double prime. So there is a minimum here which is distinct, and people like to associate this with this time, which is called beta relaxation time. And so in the so-called cage picture, which I will refer to in a minute, so you have a particle which is constrained by the neighbors. And so when eventually the glass flows, because I'm one of those who believe that glasses flow, provided that, of course, that you give appropriate time, so then this will basically escape this cage. But until it does this, it will make a lot of efforts trying to find its way around. So that's a so-called rattling. So that's a very fast time. And so this is the so-called beta relaxation time. Now, you may wonder why we assign a minimum, okay, and not a peak to the time. So then we're going to argue that this is the end of this rattling process, okay? Okay, that's what we saw. Now, sorry about this, but I'll make a connection to polymers now. Because you go to polymers, which are better understood, we think, and look at this. We'll agree that, setting some details apart, aside, which I won't discuss, there is similarity. This is now G prime, and so this is the plateau. Yes, it's not so perfect, and in fact, if I had digged a little bit more into data, I would have found something better. That depends on molecular weight. But it doesn't matter. This is a regime where if you only observe here, your system is a solid. It happens to be elastic, whereas so far we talk mainly about plastic systems. And of course, that's now our alpha relaxation here. And so this one here, I would not dare to say that it's beta relaxation, but certainly we know, okay, that it is a motion within the constraint, which now it's the so-called tube. Okay. So now the reason I bring this up, because as some of you know, in the literature, there have been claims that the same phenomenon, you see now the stress, as I showed in the very beginning, goes through a peak, and that's, you remember I mentioned it's a static yield stress, obviously occurs in polymers, and people suggested that entangled polymers yield, okay, and so that's a yielding transition. And in a way, setting aside semantics, it's true that this defines the transition to flow. Okay, so now this means, and by the way, you can do the same thing with oscillatory measurements here. You have the same thing. Usually in polymers, you don't have this peak in G double prime, but I would now say that this is secondary. Now, I guess this can lead us in suggesting that this is the map of the whole range of, I would say, nanometer size systems of concern, right? And everything goes to caging. And so now when you have many polymers in solution, you have the entanglements, and I will not say anything about this because we won't deal with this anymore. But there is only one point I would like to make. These entanglements occur at very high concentration. So then if I use a volume fraction here, and so I'm going to come to this in a minute, because this is one of the open issues, like how do you define volume fraction? Okay? And so here I'm going to use the distance from the overlap concentration, the so-called C star, right? So then you increase the number of coils in your solution. At some point your coils overlap, so that's your C star. So then, because the polymers are fractals and extremely soft, you can increase the concentration further, and then they will interpenetrate. So then, that's the reason why your volume fraction is larger than one. And in that case, you have entanglements. And so this is, of course, well known as one of the great successes of, I think, physics in general, I would say, dare to say. So now, in harsh spheres, as we all know, we have the gauging here. And so we know that typically around 0.55, 56, we have the thermal glass transition. And problem now here is that unlike this regime, where you have basically far too many chains surrounding the test chain so that you can do mean field theories, and that's the reason the field advanced so much. Here you cannot do this, right? Because the coordination number on the sphere, I think, is up to 12 or something like that. Okay, so then you cannot really do mean field theories, and people have used different approaches. I'm sure most of you are far better, in better position to discuss this than I am, but this is MCT, right? Mode coupling theory, and that's solved class rheology. These theories are obviously more phenomenological, but highly successful in predicting aspects of the linear and nonlinear response of the systems. Now, if you have softness, the only difference from the hard spheres is that you can have some kind of interpenetration, as you had before, and you can have some kind of change in the shape of your particles, right? And that's, oops, here it is. And that's now a way to characterize softness. It's semi-empirical, but I think it's useful. So the softest possible particle is a polymer coil, and the hardest is a hard sphere, right? So we can obviously define them in terms of the interaction potential. That's the hard sphere, and then softness will basically make this much broader ranged, and so on, simply because you have also this interpenetration. But then you can do something also very simple, but I think it's quite fine. That's what we call a normalized elasticity parameter. We obviously here, unlike granular matter, we have our thermal energy unit, right, which helps, because then I normalize the free energy, basically this is the elastic energy for the formation of a particle with this. And so then for a polymer coil, basically this is of the order one, whereas for the hard sphere is infinite, right? And in between I have the soft system. And now the good thing is that obviously here this can go forever because chemistry is the leader. The chemistry is far ahead of physics. And I know that Michel, who was here in January, discussed a lot about this thing. And maybe, and yesterday actually Matt Helgeson discussed emulsions and so on. Now, for instance, here the interfacial tension dictates this. Here, this is dictated by the cross-link density, okay, and the size of the segment between cross-links. Here, oops, where is this? Yeah, here or here is the number of the arms that play the key role. But that's, I think, a reasonable way to classify softness. And people have really advanced the field. Because it is possible also to determine the interaction potential of a creature like this or like this. And in fact, Peter, who is here, has done a lot of work with model microgel systems, and I will refer to that in a minute as well. Okay, so now with this in mind, the question is, how do we understand the system? So then you start from basically the structure, as I mentioned. And so this is a one-dimensional diagram, because I'm not going to use temperature at the moment. Okay. And so as I mentioned, I'm going to use this definition for the volume fraction, which is not good. There are approaches now, and I have some reference here. Some include Peter's work to understand this a little bit better. Problem is that as you go to jamming, it's not only the interpenetration or the partial overlap that takes place, but also because of osmotic pressure, the systems may compress. And I will show the consequence of this later on. So we use now this one here, which is clean definition, but nevertheless, you know, it's not great. So everything is based on the single particle, right? So this is basically number concentration of your particles, and that's the volume of the single particle. Right. Okay, so then if you have a hard sphere, we know that we go from fluid. I'm going to omit the crystallization, which we know takes place. And then we have two regimes of glass, the entropic and the jammed, right? Problem is that in the soft systems, and I use microgel and stars, you go from a fluid, which the fluid region for the microgel is almost the same. For stars, is larger. And for, obviously, polymers is the whole thing. The polymers will never vitrify themselves in solution. Right? These regimes become a little bit more complicated. Okay, so there is recent work suggesting that there is a way to separate entropic from jammed glass in microgel, so basically in systems which will only adjust their shape, okay, and volume when they are in contact, they create these facets. But this is far more complicated or blurred or maybe impossible in the case of stars, and I will allude to this. By the way, that's another good thing that happened here in discussing with Paddy Royal about this, and I think Sid, you were also in the discussion at the time. He mentioned the Gardner transition. So I admit that I have no idea what it is. Okay, so that's a good thing for me. Understand that it's this strange phase between glass and jump regime. But somehow he pointed that this, especially for soft system, may make the whole distinction of the two even more complicated. Okay, so there are things to learn here. All right, so basically I mentioned this, but what our strategy with Michel was is the following. So in all this zoo of source systems, you have basically deformable spheres, which can be either with or without dangling ends. Okay, so if they are without dangling ends, those are typical examples, and I know that Michel discussed this, and also Peter works with this a lot. And so this is a typical microscope image, fluorescent of course, of the jamming regime, and you can clearly see the facet formation and so on. So then to understand this property, the properties of the systems, and we talk mainly about the mechanical response, one needs really to understand the role of this context. Right, and so this is.
So in soft systems, what is the precise definition of jamming?
The precise definition of the jamming is actually unknown, I think, but it's mainly a geometric frustration that leads to some kind of change in the initial shape, like for instance through these contacts and so on. Is something
so
that
it's looking at the facets.
Right, right. And so that's why we, and not only we, right, as a community, before you reach jamming, we talk about thermal glass. Still, Brownian motion is the key, right? As soon as we reach jamming, this is not important anymore. Contact mechanics, or I would dare to say
it's
friction.
Contact.
Right, exactly, right.
I guess often arbitrary definitions also relate to the development of your mean square displacement.
Yeah,
because you basically go down to extremely low values here, it sort of levels off. There's something like 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 of your diameter squared.
Just looking at particles.
Right. Okay. And the other possibility is also, I think, your modulus, your shear modulus typically evolves from a caging value, goes very steeply up, and then sort of makes again a transition, something like linear dependence on your effective volume fraction.
The reason I was asking
this is coming up. Yeah.
That the in the hard system, the distinction that's made coming from the jammed side and becoming unjammed is the shear modulus disappears, but the bulk modulus stays.
Yeah. Right.
So G over B is the.
Yeah. No, here we have, I mean, and this is still arguable, right? We have this exactly what Peter says that I will show you. In the jump state, we still talk about.
And I shouldn't have said hard system, soft speed.
No, it's okay. Yeah. And we still have a shear modulus, which, however, has a much weaker dependence. Okay, it's linear, and I will show you this in a minute. Now, having said that, let me just make one point that in the jump state, the development, the most advanced, I think, model is that from Cloutier and Bongates. They have this elasto-hydrodynamic model, and so they do scale properties with the bulk modulus of the material, right? Okay. But it is universally seen that this linear dependence holds, and I'll show this in a minute. So now, of course, once you have dangling ends, you are in this regime here, and so then you have this interpenetration, and so this now brings a little bit back the concept of entanglements, of course, but still the behavior can be a little bit different. But if you wish, facets and in the penetration are the two aspects. Hence the desire to look, to decouple these two, even though they are not fully decoupled, because these guys here will also, they will compress actually due to osmotic effects, but nevertheless to look at these two systems. Obviously there are complications, because there are macrophages like some of those that I think Peter is studying, where you can have again both, right? So you can have macro, I mean, usually macrophages have dangling ends, and I think he knows more about this. Okay, so now let me just flash this. So then, since we work with stars and microgems, very quickly, stars are synthesized with the most precise chemistry. That's anionic polymer synthesis, which allows to create a core onto which independently synthesized linear polymers are coupled chemically, right? And so this is the cartoon of the core and then the chains here, right? This is done with, in our days with the highest possible precision. So these spheres are monodispersed. This is as monodispersed as mankind can make. So the so-called polydispersity coefficient is 1.02, 1.03, and so on. This is really the best that at the moment people can do. Typical functionality depends on the initial core that you make and on different other tricks which we won't discuss now, but many of the systems I will show have 800 arms. Usually to have interesting phenomena you need to be above 60 or something arms, right? Now arm size for a particular system here is, just to give you an idea, 5 kilograms per mole. So if you multiply this by the number of arms, you see that the molecular weight is really huge, right? The order of millions. Okay, and so now these are nanometer scales. So typically the radius is on the order of 20 to 30 to 40 nanometers. It depends on the combination of functionality and arm size. By the way, these are also well understood. I don't have it here, but I can discuss if you wish, with scaling models that go back actually to Degen era, and actually Daoun Coton were the two people who discussed the static. So that basically you understand there is a monomer density distribution here. Near the core, the monomers are high density, almost melt-like. Outside, it's lower, it's simply topological, so this has been understood in detail. On the other hand, microgels are made in different ways. This particular one is actually from a copolymerization of methacrylic acid and thylacrylate with a particular fraction of crosslinker, which will dictate the crosslink density, therefore the particle modulus. This particular quote recipe here ensures as much as possible that there are no dangling ends. There's a much bigger, in the order of hundreds of nanometers. And, sorry.
Roughly uniform density, bunch of radius.
You cannot tell. This is unknown. You make this as, sorry?
It's made in emulsion drops.
Yeah, it's emulsion polymerization. Yeah. You make this assumption, but you know it's not true. And as far as I know, this is still one of the issues. Okay, but they're really well-defined systems. This is not as monodispersed as this one, but this is really very nice. Okay, so one more thing, I will go quickly. Actually, Matt alluded to this yesterday, so it was very nice. So this is, you remember, Matt showed the same thing. This is the attraction strength, and that's the volume fraction. and so now you start with spheres, and let's say hard spheres here. And so you are a volume fraction where they form a glass, let's say 0.58 or 0.6 or something like that. And then you can add attractions. In this case, they will be done not with temperature, but with adding a non-absorbing smaller species, which can be a linear polymer. And so then you have the phenomenon of depletion going back to the 50s, simply because there is an excluded region in the neighborhood of two spheres where it costs a lot of entropy for a polymer to go in, so then the polymer stays outside, and therefore they create, because of entropy of mixing, a pressure, which is osmotic in nature, okay? And this is called depletion effect, because then you have a binding which is entropic in origin. So this has been shown to be an extremely powerful way to manipulate properties, and my colleague George Petikidis, who was here in January, discussed different aspects of the states that result from this phenomenon with respect to structure and rheology. So now, the reason I mention this is that, and that's what, for instance, George also showed, you start from this repulsive glass, so then you add linear polymers, so you add attractions. At some point, because of depletion, so you form randomly some clusters, so overall you open up the space, right, in the solvent, so then you make a fluid, right? So in a way, the fluid percolates the sample, if you wish. But then as you keep on adding attractions, so then that's the cartoon here, your cage becomes strongly binded because of the particle-particle bonds, right? And so then you have the so-called attractive glass. Okay, so now for this to happen, the polymer ought to be much smaller than the colloids, typically 10% of size. So now if you have soft spheres, and this will be stars, you have the same phenomenon, but with one important difference. The osmotic forces will first act on the particle and compress it, and then bind it with others. Okay. As a result of this, you have the same diagram here, like here. So you start from a glass, you have a liquid, often the liquid region is higher, but then the reentrant phase, or state actually, because no thermodynamic, is not a glass, but it's a gel. Okay. And so you can do the same by changing the size ratio. But if we stay on this, I can explain why this happens. And so to do so, let's start with the glass, the repulsive glass. As I showed before, that's typically, it's viscoelastic response, which is the indirect structural information that we get. So now this is deep into the jumped regime, if you wish, because the effective volume fraction is almost 4, right? This is C over C star based on the definition I made. And so now, when you add linear polymers, as I mentioned, you are going to compress this. And what happens is that you have your star, and then you have the little linear polymers, which will not penetrate it, and so they will really push it apart. And so you can understand this by writing down the free energy of the system as having three contributions. Those two are, for those in the field, the classic Flory contributions. So this is an elastic contribution, because basically this here is an elastic object, right? And it's basically, it has the entropy elasticity. This one here is the so-called excluded volume effect, okay, which is typical for polymers in a particular solvent, usually a good solvent. And this here is a term because of this phenomenon. And so the idea here is that the star creates an effective cavity, which actually prohibits the linear polymers to enter, right? And so then if you work out this, and I don't have the details, but, you know, I can show you if you wish later. So then you can find the size, how it changes with addition of the osmotic basically pressure, which is the linear polymers. And the size changes a lot to the degree that the effective volume fraction now, which scales with size to -3 power, right, goes down more than 10 times. So now this, for those in the field, is the typical fraction where hard colloidal gels are seen, all right? So that's one argument. The other is that when you see now, in this case here, so the, for the particular fraction of linear chains added, the modulus is completely different, right? And so you have this low frequency plateau here, which now is 2 decades below that of the glass, and gels have lower plateau modulus because there are more fractal objects, more open space, etc., less dense, if you wish. And so this is also a signature of glass. Okay. So then you see that you can easily manipulate the products of the systems, and then go from gel to glass, etc. All right. So then this can be also seen with intermediate scattering functions. So then you can do dynamic light scattering. And so this is the intermediate scattering function. So you start with a single star or a star with a certain concentration, and you have this kind of behavior. Actually, this is not single, it's a little bit in the concentrated regime. And then what you see is that you can increase the concentration further to create a glass. And so then when you have a glass, what you see is that there is a process that will not relax. This is the so-called non-ergodic plateau. And so then there are people who can do this really carefully, like Peter or Luca Cipelletti, etc., etc. The point, however, here is to show you how versatile the systems are. If you now add to these systems some linear chains, which are going, as I claim, or as I hope I show, compress the stars, so then obviously the thing will change. In this case, it doesn't form a gel, it forms a liquid, okay? And so you can see that it goes back here. And this is really decays in time, right? So this is simply by compression. The system is fully responsive. Okay, so now the next thing to deal with the systems is aging, right? And so I know that this has been discussed, and also that George discussed this, and perhaps Michelle. So now, this is another zoo here, and so there are, I know there are people who really spent all their efforts in understanding aging. One thing I want to point out here is that unlike hard spheres, with soft spheres, there is no universality in the aging. So this is a typical aging that one can see with hard spheres and microgels. For example, that's the G prime that increases. That's the so-called logarithmic increase. It's also has seen in often in polymer glasses. And in fact, there are ways to extract some universalities based on the so-called waiting time. I mean, typically, what do you do? You need to find a protocol to anneal your sample. Unlike polymers where you heat them and then you are happy because they are properly annealed and then you cool them, here you have to basically anneal them mechanically, which is a big issue, and then bring them back, like quench them, to the state where there should be, again, this metastable state, a glass or a gel, wait a certain time and then measure properties. Okay, this waiting time, okay, has certain scaling and so on for microgels and for hard spheres, but not for stars. Okay? You see, the stars may have, unlike this logarithmic increase, they have this kind of two-step increase. It's not always like this. So this depends now on functionality and so on. Okay, and so it's very hard to understand what's going on. So recently, what we did is we kind of built a kind of shrink device into the light scattering cell. So basically, that's your light scattering cell. And so what you do is you shear your sample, mimicking what is the mechanical pre-shearing protocol. And so the advantage in doing this here is that you can measure the intermediate scattering function. And so what you see is, I show you here, two distinct curves. None of them is nice, as you will see, and the experts understand, because the system remains non-ergodic. So the two correspond to those two times, the early time here and the slow time here. But then if you zoom in here, you will see that the early response is the same for both. Now, the early response, we know from independent studies, has to do with what we call the cooperative diffusion because of the star penetration. And so then the suggestion, which remains suggestion at the time, is that the way aging proceeds is as follows. So you break mechanically your samples, so you tear apart the stars, and then because they are also elastic, they will immediately re-engage. Okay. Once this is done, you have a larger scale rearrangement, which is akin to what happens in hard spheres and microgels, okay, which is a long time cooperative motion that requires, of course, at the size of the cage a response. And sure enough, this one here, I don't like to talk about logarithmic increase when I have a small scale here, but certainly is reminiscent of this kind of behavior. Okay. So now, for whatever I will show you, we won't worry about aging because we'll reach a regime where we have nearly time-independent properties, right? So now temperature is the other control parameter, which again I will not say much, but just I want to show you the versatility of things. So this is a PNIPA microgel, like the ones that Peter has been studying extensively for quite some time. And so you see that if you increase the temperature, this belongs to what we call low LCST. Low concentration solution, low critical solution temperature, right? Thank you. Right, and so then that means that with increasing temperature, you introduce attraction to the system, and eventually phase separates. So now the single particle will drop its size like this, and so then if you see here, this is a bit busy slide, but it's just indicative. You start with a low temperature like this. The temperature. Sorry, low temperature somewhere here. You increase temperature, the size decreases, it goes something like this. But then, when the size becomes lower here, you go into the phase separation regime, and before that, the system really has attractions, right? And so then the modulus goes skyrocket up here, right? And so this can be done systematically and so on. You can have the opposite effect, and this is easily seen in systems like stars, when you put them in a solvent which is not athermal, right? So this is what we call intermediate or marginally good solvent. So in that case, with increasing temperature, the size will increase, right? And so then, of course, the consequences in both cases on the volume fraction change are dramatic. And so what you see here is that unlike this case, you have low temperature liquid response and high temperature glass or solid response. Okay, so it's extremely nice way to manipulate this. And by the way, in this way you can also avoid the notorious mechanical rejuvenation protocols. Okay, so now let's move on and see now. Okay, so now we have the systems. So then we can measure, for instance, viscosity. What is the reflection of softness? So this is a bit more complicated plot than the one that John Brady showed a couple of days ago. So I show here the normalized to the solvent viscosity as function of this effective volume fraction, right? And so this is what John discussed. That's Hartsphere data. John showed more data. I'll show you only one set. But these are classic sets from Jan Mavis and Bill Russell, right? And so people understand this, I think, reasonably well, even though it was clear that still people can talk about this pressure effect and so on. So now, once you make your system softer in any of the ways that I indicated, for instance, think of microgel or think of grafted spheres and so on, the data shift to the right, but in a reasonably consistent way. So then you have microgels, you have which are here, you have stars. This is also, I think, it's a star. Yeah, this one is grafted particles and so on, and all the way to polymers. So now, when you have polymers, you know the scaling. You go to Rubinstein-Kolbe and you see it, depending on the solvent quality and so on. So this is nice, well understood, right? So then this shows how the interaction potential essentially and the softness of the particles, which are interrelated, really affects the viscosity. That's a log-log plot. Interestingly, here I show also data. You see there are two symbols of the inverse self-diffusion measured by scattering. And you see that the data go very well together. Now, of course, one thing of interest is this here behavior. So this one here, again, is a reflection of this compression that I mentioned, right? You keep on increasing your concentration, and you reach a point where basically you squeeze your particles osmotically, and then they will, in a way, diswell, right? And in that particular work, there were some simulations done by Likos, with whom we collaborate for also a long time, and he showed that at least this can explain the phenomenon. Of course, you squeeze them out to a certain point, and then they will keep on increasing. By the way, this is, of course, general, has been seen by many others. So now, a note here. So if I forget about this, and I say that, okay, I measure up to here, right? I didn't measure higher. then I can easily then, of course, fit the data with Krieger Doherty or whatever your preference is, and then extrapolate data and find the maximum packing fraction that people also may define as glass volume fraction, right? And so here is what I tend to show you, okay? So then look, these data here are almost linear. And then if I did that, okay, I haven't done it, right? But people have, right? I can shift the data here. And so then I will have the initial Hertzsphere data, and then I have the soft, which are like this. Obviously, in such case, I have normalized with respect to my glass transition fraction, right? So now this is interesting because people have used this as a way to draw analogies with other types of glasses. This is the so-called angel plot. So the Hertzspheres are what we call fragile glasses. Okay, and that's very typical of many of the molecular glass formers, right? And so the soft spheres are what they call strong glasses. So this has been an effort. Actually, the work was done with microgels, but there are many issues. Nevertheless, I think it's a very interesting analogy. And I will come back to this because I had a good discussion with Sid, and I think drawing analogies with molecular glasses is certainly interesting and challenging. Obviously, one thing that I find a bit strange in this representation is that I could even extrapolate somehow the polymers, and then the polymer solution would be the strongest glass ever, right? Which obviously is not the case. But nevertheless, I think it's interesting. Okay, so now we come finally to flow curves. And so what I show you here again is a flow curve. Now you see that I already scale it because, as Peter reminded me, I'm a chemical engineer. But this is actually a scaling that goes back to previous work by Michel Kroc, but now it's used universally. So now I'm going to scale the stress with the yield stress and the shear rate here with a time, which I will claim is a typical time of the system. And this is the solvent viscosity over the shear modulus of the material. And this is what I was saying, that for highly packed systems, they pretty much change this with the modulus of the bulk modulus of the material. So now this here is before the glass, right, a concentrated solution. By the way, this system here is a star polymer solution. This is something that now has a yield stress, right? And then, yeah.
So just back to your statement, why the solvent viscosity? Is that just because that's the only thing that's on hand?
Well,
eight over G naught isn't, eight S over G naught isn't.
I'll tell you, the logic behind this is basically the hydrodynamics. Right? Because especially in this regime here, you have predominance of hydrodynamic effects which basically control the phenomenon. That was the logic behind it. And in fact, you can work out the drag force on the system and the elastic force, and then if you make the balance, really you find also the... Okay, so now what we do now, we go back to our beloved Herschel bulk plate.
Just so I understand, the green... Is it 2C star and the black is between 2.5 and 3.5?
Right.
It's two concentration levels.
No, sorry. This is the range, and this is because you see that there will more coming up, okay. Right? Yeah. Okay. If you want the exact, I think the 2C star for sure is this one here. But, okay. Yeah. By the way, this is the work of Michel that I know that he alluded to when he was here in January. Sorry?
What's the difference between those curves?
Yeah, we don't get the difference.
Sorry, I didn't...
The green is low concentration.
This is a lower concentration where the system is flowing, okay. Right? And so as you increase the concentration, it becomes a glass, okay. Right? And so then you have a yield stress. So then, you know, after all this, what did I manage to do? To find what turbopole people found, okay? And it took much more effort. But okay, there is more coming up. No, but you understand, it's not a Krishna thing. It's I really hope that we bring the communities together, and that's the point. Okay, so then you...
Yeah. You showed us some data before when you where you could go up on a floating curve and back on a yield. That's not these.
No, no. So the data are shown that...
Are these reversible going up and down on both?
They are almost fully reversible.
Okay.
Right.
So yeah. Different
ways. Yeah, and this, if you want to discuss, because this is, we have done this and we've seen. And I will... I will iterate my claim that when you are in the very dense regime, with the soft systems, this also applies not to microgels, they are reversible. Thixotropic effects are found in particular when you have attractions. So then when you basically introduce another time scale in your system, right? Okay, so now that's Herschel-Buckley. You see that the slope of 1/2, actually the line should be here, but we'll come back to this. It's pretty much obeyed. And this explains, I know that there is recent argumentation by theorists. I have to admit that I'm not up to date with the latest, but I think that people agree that here 1/2 is a good description. Certainly it is for soft systems, but I will come back to this. Right, so now that's the yield stress here, and this is a regime where the shear bonding, and I show you earlier work, that was done actually with Paul Callahan in New Zealand, and so actually by Simon Rogers, who was his student, who spent some time a few years with us. So then you have two regions here. So this is pretty much the gap in your rheometer, and this is the velocity, and you have an immobile region, which actually now, depending on the aging, okay, will change, right? And so that's what this shows here, right? The immobile region will reach a plateau at very long aging times, and as I mentioned, we are basically working now in this regime here.
This is the aging time before you turn flow on.
This one here.
The time during flow.
This one here, no, before.
And so these are steady state profiles?
Yeah, right. Right, okay. Yeah. And so then that's the second band. Okay, so now this thing really bands, okay, and it has a yield plateau. So then the next question is, this is a soft system, and I show you linear response. Can I really determine now the alpha relaxation time, so can I really see this soft glass relaxing? And the answer is yes, okay. If you do measurements here, you see that now the range of rates, or normalized rates, you span is really huge, it's 10 decades. This can be done for those interested with creep measurements. It cannot be done with oscillatory measurements or even with steady shear measurements. But by the way, all these data are based on transient response, as I show as the main experiment. They are not really sweeping data, right? But anyway, that's an interesting thing, that you see that now you have what now we call that these are soft glasses with observable terminal relaxation. And that brings also an analogy with the polymers, but obviously the polymers in the respective regime have the entanglement, so they are basically dominated by elasticity, whereas this one here I would say is viscoplasticity. Right? I found that it's extremely interesting to draw analogies here with the recent work that Sid have done with metallic glasses, where he sees, and correct me Sid if I don't say it right, also three regimes, right? Certainly a flow regime, which was a big surprise to me, very interesting, an intermediate regime, not now bonding, but certainly an intermediate regime, and then a higher rate regime, okay? Okay, so now, of course, the next thing one can do is one can say, okay, let me go now from the concentrated fluid state to the glassy state.
Before you do that, you showed this data of the solid fraction as a function of aging time. Does the yield, apparent yield stress also change there as well?
We'll come to this. It does, but rather weakly. And so I can tell you from now, in case I forget, although I think I have a slide, that's another big difference from hard spheres. The yield modulus will depend nearly linear, the yield stress linearly on the concentration. Whereas for hard spheres, it will
be in particular, if you were to take an aging time small enough where this fraction was zero, Mm-hmm. Do you still find it?
Well, what I can tell you is what we have done at the edge system, right? We have not done systematically. All right. Okay, that's an intermediate situation. And now this is something which I think is interesting. You see the blue data. So now, the blue data do not suggest that I have a yield stress. Yet, I'm going to claim that I have, because when you do oscillatory measurement, you find this crossover from a solid to liquid regime. Okay? So,
what's the blue data from?
The blue data is an intermediate concentration.
It's just another concentration.
It's another concentration, okay? So now, what's going on? If I have a yield stress, I should have a plateau here, right? And so, well, first of all, can I fit the data? Yeah, okay, I'm basically taking empirically another expression for the Herschel-Bagley, and it works, no big deal. The good thing is that I have the high rate regime preserved, right? We have only seen this in such grafted spheres, and we think that this relates to the fact that as I increase the concentration, it becomes more and more difficult for the system, even though I say that we look at edge systems and so on, to really reach true quasi-equilibrium, because now you need to have penetration, right? And so for penetration to happen, you need to have the star arms from another one inserted here. For this to happen, you need to overcome the osmotic pressure. Yet, the osmotic pressure at the time of overlap and beyond increases dramatically, and that's actually it's something that I actually Phil Pinkus with Tom Witten at the time and Mike Cates discovered, because the osmotic pressure scales as KT per size cube to the star, but at the overlap is size cube of the blob, the outer blob, right, which is much smaller. So therefore, the pressure you need to introduce, okay, to really do the interpenetration much higher. And then, of course, at higher concentration, you have higher pressure, so then it's kind of easier. So that's our interpretation. In fact, there are light scattering data, which I can show you if you want, but I don't have them coming up, which at least suggests that this is not inconceivable. In other words, this cooperative diffusion that I mentioned is delayed.
So another way to think about it could be that, I mean, it's sort of the same thing, but so as you change the degree of penetration, you change the ability to have this slow traction of the disentanglement.
Yes, yes.
So it's as if you're just marching that time scale in and out,
yeah.
And then that time scale at low times just sort of disappears under the gamma dot to the half.
Yeah. I think it's similar.
Getting a separation. Similar, yeah. In the polymer case, when you get separation between the repetition and the rouse times, you get that far enough, then you can get banded.
I agree. In fact, I will show something similar to this later on. Okay. Now, of course, somebody will ask, and how do I know that this is not a slip? You remember, in the beginning I said that it's a slip. Well, we are confident it's not a slip, first because I want, for example, okay, this is work by Thibaut Duvaux, who showed, again, this is one of these carbopoles, but if you focus on this only, okay, you see that without slip you go here, with slip drops. It's exactly like I showed. And by the way, I know that Thibaut, Guillaume, and Sebastian discussed slip extensively, right, in January here. Okay. Why it's not? Oops. I really want to show this because Matt Helgeson, when he was a student in Delaware, and I was there on sabbatical, worked together also with Norm Wagner on this problem. And so this, for some reason, we never published, but I like it a lot, because that's a rheologist approach to like a quick and dirty test to ensure that you have or you don't have slip. So what you see, this is pretty much reproducible data. with different geometries, right? And in particular, in the case of parallel plate, when you change the gap, this is established as really and shown that it works reasonably well. So then we claim that there is no really slip. Now, there are additional things that have been done, and we have, you can measure the contact angle of your system, your polymer, your star suspension on the substrate, which is the rheometer plate, and then based on the contact angle, you can estimate an adhesion energy and so on. So based on this, we are confident that slip is not the problem with us. Okay. Now, let's go back to the flow curve. And so this is the normalized data that I show. But now, what I show you here is microgels, stars, and glaucopolymer micelles, which, if you wish, are in the family of stars. And the data, I think, I hope you will agree that they collapse, right? So then, that's a very good scaling. And then, there is an obvious question, which we have not really asked before. How about hard spheres, right? And so then, let's take one fraction of hard spheres. This is data, actually, from home with George. You would say, okay, well, I'm not sure, it's not great, I can see here something. Okay, let's take another fraction, because fraction obviously is not a variable here, and then it doesn't work at all, right? So then clearly, this scaling, it's not universal. I don't know why, and we have discussed actually this a bit, and we're not sure. The only thing is that there are different types of interactions.
So these are hard spheres at different concentrations.
That's yes, yes, right. So as we know, for hard spheres, hydrodynamics dominates the response. And now somebody may say, we are not in the jamming regime, OK? So I think what I say is undisputed.
But what are the concentrations of hard spheres for these?
I really don't remember, but certainly you are not in the close point.
Are your soft particles substantially changing their shape as you get into that limiting asymptotic region?
You mean because of the flow?
Yeah. If they're not spheres anymore, then you wouldn't expect them to line up.
Right. I don't know for sure, but I do know that if I have one of those particles in dilute solution and I shear it, I need to go to extremely high Wassermann numbers in order to deform it, right? So obviously here is different. This we have not studied, but I would expect that this may happen. Now, this whole analysis, it does not account for this. It accounts from the so-called elastohydrodynamic model, the fact that because of, there is an osmotic compression of the systems, so then they form facets. So this is the elastic part, okay? If they were not elastic, that means having low modulus, this would not happen. And so the flow, it's basically taking place via lubrication, okay, between facets. So then this picture doesn't require or doesn't take into account this thing. But this could be the case. Okay, the fact that you have... there are some details which show that this picture is not, you know, does not hold for the whole range of fractions, etc., etc., okay? But I think to a first approach, that's where we stand. Okay, so now, so for the dense soft systems, as I indicated, elastic interactions are important. So I think this is the difference of the two, which actually is important to consider. So now, obviously, this opens Pandora's box with respect to shear bonding, right? And so I have several experts here, so I have to be careful. But I think I have what I write here. Yeah, it's better seen here. So now, I have. So far, we went through, you know, jamming, okay, this geometric effect, the linear response, yield stress, wall slip, shear bonding. So now, this is, Peter, what I was saying before. This actually from Andy Borough group at the time George was there. That's the yield stress versus the volume fraction. And so this is two different sizes. And you see you have this strong dependence. I think it diverges with Feynman's to the third power. So then I would say for hard spheres I have strong dependence, and so the prevailing theoretical idea is this flow concentration coupling. So in other words, you have an heterogeneous concentration of the particles, you know, when they are sheared, and then this coupled with the flow will create this shear band. So now stars also shear band in a little bit different way, as I mentioned. I'm not sure if we should call it classic scenario or not, because they have this immobile band and then this band. But when I see the yield stress as function of concentration, it has a linear dependence, so much weaker dependence. Okay, that's one thing. But they do exhibit shear thinning. Now I call it strong, but this is arguable. Okay, what strong means. Okay, but certainly the shear thing can really reach almost the slope of minus one, which is seen also from the plateau module, from the flow curve. What is unknown is why, or let's say not fully understood, at least by me, is why microgels, when they are repulsive, they do not bond. And so there have been many efforts to look at this. They don't. The only way to see bonding is through slip, if they slip. But then if you properly account for this with treating of surfaces, and Michel has seen this in great detail, then they don't bond. Okay? And so on the other hand, if you introduce attractions, as I think he showed in January, they do bond. Right? So for me, what is interesting in this at the end of the day is what I mentioned here. So these engagements through this penetration, they are basically, some people like Brills call them transient forces, right? But they are effective attractions. They just have a much shorter time scale than the attractions you introduce via other means, right? So I think this is something to consider.
Anybody studied for the repulsive microgels how much that is also linked to the fact that they strongly or strongly absorb to interface the surfaces, depending on the material, and whether that could actually prevent your shear banding?
What I know is that there is a work done primarily by Michel Quatt and Roger Bongates, where they treated the surfaces. And so they really had also attractive surfaces, okay? Mm-hmm. And so then they didn't see bonding, indeed. Right. So I would say the answer is yes. Yeah, yeah, there is actually, I think...
So they bond when they stick to the surface?
No, they would not.
They do.
They would not. Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Because sometimes slip may result into bonding, and that's why, in fact, this coexistence that I showed before also sometimes is a result of slip, which is not the case for the stars.
Because in most cases, with the materials used in your typical shear cells, I think there might be quite strong absorption of the microgels.
There may be, right. And I will show you, I hope I have time, I guess. What should I do? Should I continue?
You can continue.
Okay.
Not much longer.
Sorry about that. I'm sorry I was too slow, right?
Okay.
Okay. I didn't show my beloved shape effects, but anyway. Okay. Let me address this, and so I apologize. I will do something that I don't like when others do, and I end up doing it. Okay, so I'm going to flash a few things. By the way, now it's almost like a question session, right? So, Peter, this is, I think, the plateau modulus as function of concentration. So this is microgels, right? Okay, this will go all the way to the jump state, right? We have lots of concentration, so we fit them with a linear dependence, right? And so, in fact, you can do the same with the stars. We have much lower range with stars. But then if you believe the fit, perhaps this parameter can tell us something about the jamming, which I don't know. Okay? But this is linear, right? So I'm going to leave, there are other ways to calculate the volume fraction, but let me make one point here. Again, sorry that now I'm a little bit faster. You remember I show this stress transient, and so then you have a peak and eventually steady state, right? Okay. So this is the case of microgels. Okay, you have a peak, then you have this, I would say, gradual transition. There is something here, and then eventually you reach steady state. But look at the stars. The stars have two unique peaks, right? Okay, one is here and one is here. So, and look, they are apart by almost one decade, right? So this is what we like to call gradual yielding. And this, of course, it's interesting because this second peak occurs at this notorious value of 2, which for polymer experts, I see Joe already laughing, it's basically this value here, which is predicted by the Doy-Edwards theory. And so basically it tells me that the change, in our case, will be these arms here, will align. That's alignment. It's not stretching, it's aligned. And then in the past, two peaks have been found in attractive glasses and in gels, and actually George has studied this in great length, and I know that he has discussed this here as well. So, but here I don't introduce attractions other than these engagements that I mentioned, right? And so this is now the end result. So now I have my yield strain, and so for microgels, no matter how I measure it, it's always around 10%. In fact, any glass, colloidal glass that I take, stars here, microgels, hard spheres, rod-like systems, like the Don's pneumatic textures, I would dare to say carbopon. I have nothing against, okay? And so they all yield at 10%, which in a way it's not a huge surprise because they're all jumped, okay? So you don't need really much deformation to yield them. But I think it's interesting. Now, obviously, it's order 10%. You may have some at 5%, some at 12, but they will never be much higher. Now, the stars will have this 10%. You see it's 10 to 20, depending on whether you measure steady or oscillatory. But then the other is 10 times more, right? And so that's what I call the polymeric nature, which still we don't understand, and that's the colloidal nature, right? And so I'm going to now come to the question of somehow Peter to address it again. So now that's what we did here. So this is now the microgels, and let's look at flow curves. And so this is with smooth plates. So you see that you have, of course, slip. And that's with rough plates. Okay. And so when you measure the velocity profiles, you see clearly that you have slip here. Now, you can keep on measuring. And so this is now at higher concentration. And so then you say, OK, I don't have slip. Everything is fine. But then after longer time, the measurement becomes a little bit strange, right? Certainly the curve is, you know, there is maybe some slip here, but, oh, maybe you say, okay, I have bonding. Huh? But then you look at your sample and some of the sample is expelled here, okay? So this is good news for us because that means that you have now edge fracture, right? And so your system, even if we call it viscoplasmic, has sufficient elasticity to develop single normal stress, which will overcome the interfacial tension. And this is something that we're going to study because we think that we can do. Okay, so look, I have a summary now here. Sorry, it's too big. But I have tried to put some thoughts together, which, as you probably recognize, are already random in my own head. So, but I think it's a huge field. And so what we try to do is to remove the question of the system microstructure from the table, right? And so I didn't show also lots of scattering data. that really help to characterize both systems, right? So then I think jamming remains very ambiguous in soft systems, but we all agree that elastic interactions are important and they are the new, if you wish, parameter to consider compared to the hard spheres or to the granular systems, right? The yielding is a gradual process. I'll show a little bit of this, and very much depends on microstructure. You see, it's different in stars compared to microgels, and also, as I mentioned, when you have attractions, it's also different. Shear bonding, the problem is microgels at the moment, or problem anyway. I think, by the way, it's not only microgels, the Martians pretty much show the same thing. So then again, this elastic context may be the key. Wall slip. I think that we can avoid it and control it, but microgels are particularly prone to slip. Now, the flow curves are universal for the soft systems, but certainly not for the entire range, since this exponent is not obeyed by the heart. So I indicated this time scale based on the hydrodynamics, but there is more than one time scale in systems like the stars, because obviously you have the particle time scale and then you have the arm relaxation. We think that's behind the two yield strains that I indicated. And I show that osmotic interactions are, I think, a nice way to control flow through both channels, okay, the compression of the particle as well as the depletion effects. Now, going back to the start, we do expect quicker thickening in soft systems, even though, as I mentioned, Prabhu has some fantastic data that show very strong shear thickening. And I think it's nice to explore analogies with molecular glasses. And so the bottom line is that at contact, we have the facets that we know, but also I'd like to bring this idea of engagements, which are important. They can be considered also as a source of attraction. And so then, I wonder whether one can also revisit or at least think also of these friction effects in this context. All these things are elements of friction. In what I apologize if I talk too long, that I guess I haven't managed to show is that, but let me make a small summary. If you have anisotropic particles, okay, I'm talking about grafted, we have 2 minutes or three? Okay, well, maybe I'll go very quickly. Let me tell you why we think shape is important, right? If you have spheres, you go directly from an isotropic system to a crystal, and then obviously to a gel. Now, once you introduce shape, you go to this intermediate phase, right? Different nematic phases, and I think those are very important. And in fact, people have seen, as we have actually, but I will show you, that you have glasses in this regime as well, okay? And so our approach has been this one, okay? So you have a sphere, a cylinder and maybe a lamella, where you can, with the chemistry, going back to block polymer physics, have exactly the same grafting density and the same size of the grafts. So then this is a very good system to study. I won't bother you with details, but the point is that same grafting density here and here means that this has order of magnitude more arms, but then because in the dense state, you go back to Doi-Edwards theory, your perpendicular diffusion is pretty much hindered. Here, due to the penetration, your parallels hinder as well, right? So then this is really... Exactly. And I think, yeah, and that's exactly what we have seen, because based on the measurements, we can estimate this, and you see that you have a dramatic delay because of this. And I really think this is friction, okay? So sorry if this was fast, but anyway, I guess, thank you very much.
I guess, I don't know if there are questions. So the star polymer-like systems, when they're simulated with these ultra-soft potentials?
Yes, yes. And
And is there jamming observed in ultrasoft potential?
No. I'll tell you what I know. The answer is no. So this, you understand, it's really coarse-grained because they are treated as point particles,
correct.
Right? Yeah. And so I take issues with friend Likos, even though it really, we learned many things thanks to their simulations. Obviously, they see the difference in mean squared displacement and so on, but there is no signature of jamming. I think not for stars, but for soft systems, the close to jamming in terms of simulation is recent work of Berthier, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And so, that you, I'm sure you know. Yes, you meant with the stars, but yeah, it's always there is always steady state. Mm-hmm. We have no clear evidence of transient banding. I don't say it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. I would maybe take issues with the suggestion that any transient stress curve. Thanks, Joe. I see that you agree. Necessarily reflects transient banding, but yeah, we have an answer.
I think we can continue the discussion over lunch.
Yes. Yeah.